Paris in August 2014, the Indian historian Charu Gupta calls attention to an aggressive, systematic campaign, including awareness rallies, organized by RSS and some factions of the dominant Hindu Nationalist Party, BJP, about the supposed Love Jihad movement, which, according to the BJP, compelled Hindu women to convert to Islam by marriage and deception. Gupta adds that these campaigns are based on divisive principles that are sustained by constant and repetitive references to the aggressive and libidinal energies of the Muslim male, creating a common enemy other. She decries the loss of Hindu logical faculties in the face of a politics of cultural virginity and a myth of innocence that are combined with the perceived illegitimacy of the act, leading to rants of violation, invasion, seduction, and rape. In the United States, at the moment of this writing, we also see a loss of logical faculties in the face of a barrage of propaganda connecting immigrant groups to rape. Trump famously began his campaign by denouncing Mexican immigrants to the United States as rapists. In an article for the New York Times on September 26, 2017, Caitlin Dickerson wrote about what happened in the small town of Twin Falls, Idaho, where three refugee boys, aged 7, 10, and 14, were accused of some kind of sexual activity with a 5-year-old American girl. Immediately after the incident, Facebook groups formed about it, with links to articles on the internet claiming that the little girl had been gang-raped at knife point, that the perpetrators were Syrian refugees, and that their fathers had celebrated with them afterward by giving them high fives. Soon thereafter, the headline article on the Drudge Report, one of the most visited sites on the internet, screamed, "Report! Syrian refugees rape little girl at knife point in Idaho." The articles were all false. For one thing, as Dickerson reports, no Syrian refugees were resettled in Twin Falls. It's not clear that there was any attack at all. A police officer, based on the cell phone video of the incident, called the internet descriptions of it 100% false, like not even close to being accurate. Nevertheless, the fake news stories created a wave of intimidating harassment against public officials in Twin Falls, and a storm of outrage against refugees in the community. In short, they created moral panic about the sexual danger refugees posed for American white girls, a panic that has yet to subside. The rhetoric on immigration that surrounded the Trump campaign, and continues to surround his administration, parallels the tactics of Russian propaganda outlets, which have spread fake news stories, as well as grossly exaggerating facts, about Middle Eastern immigrants raping white women in Europe. To take just one example, discussed in a September 2017 New York Times article by Jim Ruttenberg, Russian propaganda outlets tried to create a fake scandal about a supposed rape of a 13-year-old girl in Berlin by a Middle Eastern immigrant in 2016. Multiple media outlets produced stories about the supposed rape, stoking outrage among the German-Russian community, ultimately to the point where 700 people gathered to protest an event that never occurred. Russian media coverage and Russian fake news stories inflamed outrage. The fact that all of this eerily mirrors the spread of the German propaganda campaign in the 1920s of the Black Horror on the Rhine should dissuade us from adopting the view, currently in vogue, that this sort of fake news is a consequence of the modern revolution in social media. Patriarchal masculinity sets up men with the expectation that society will allow them the role of sole protectors and providers of their families. In times of extreme economic anxiety, men, already made anxious by a perceived loss of status resulting from increasing gender equality, can easily be thrust into panic by demagoguery directed against sexual minorities. Here, fascist politics intentionally distorts the source of anxiety. A fascist politician has no intention of addressing the root causes of economic hardship. Fascist politics distorts male anxiety, heightened by economic anxiety, into fear that one's family is under existential threat from those who reject its structure and traditions. Here again, the weapon used in fascist politics is a supposed potential threat of sexual assault. In March 2016, the General Assembly of North Carolina passed House Bill 2, the so-called bathroom bill. The bill mandates that local boards of education enforce single-sex, multiple-occupancy bathrooms, meaning that transgender individuals had to use the bathroom of their birth sex. Thus, a transgender girl would have to use a boy's bathroom. The entire debate surrounding the bathroom bill focused on the threat posed by transgender girls to cisgender, non-transgender girls. Its sponsors and supporters pushed for the bill by arguing that transgender girls were likely sexual predators. The Republican governor of North Carolina, Pat McCrory, justified his decision to sign the bill by arguing that House Bill 2 was necessary to protect the women of North Carolina. Legislators in more than a dozen U.S. states in 2016 considered bathroom bills modeled after House Bill 2. Julia Serrano explains in her classic work, Whipping Girl, that trans women, because they choose femininity, pose a serious threat to patriarchal ideologies. In a male-centered gender hierarchy, where it is assumed that men are better than women and that masculinity is superior to femininity, there is no greater perceived threat than the existence of trans women, who, despite being male and inheriting male privilege, choose to be female instead. By embracing our own femaleness and femininity, we, in a sense, cast a shadow of doubt over the supposed supremacy of maleness and masculinity. In order to lessen the threat we pose to the male-centered gender hierarchy, our culture, primarily via the media, uses every tactic in its arsenal of traditional sexism to dismiss us. Since the original publication of Serrano's book in 2007, rhetorical attacks on trans women have moved into the center of U.S. politics. Given the significance of gender hierarchy to fascist ideology, that politicians have been trying to foment mass hysteria about trans women is unsurprising if this effort is understood as a manifestation of fascist political tactics and a sign that fascist politics is ascendant. Conversely, the growing acceptance of trans women is a strong affirmation of liberal democratic norms. Recall the importance of the patriarchal family to fascism. The fascist leader is analogous to the patriarchal father, the CEO of the traditional family. The role of the father in the patriarchal family is to protect the mother and the children. Attacking trans women and representing the feared other as a threat to the manhood of the nation are ways of placing the very idea of manhood at the center of political attention, gradually introducing fascist ideals of hierarchy and domination by physical power to the public sphere. Maria Schmidt is a far-right Hungarian historian who is director of the Hungarian House of Terror Museum in Budapest. In an article about Schmidt's 2017 book, Language and Freedom, that a linguistics professor at the University of Vienna, Johanna Laxo, published online in the Hungarian Spectrum, Laxo describes Schmidt's enemies as Muslim immigrants, left-wing liberal elite, and George Soros. In the same review, Laxo quotes from Schmidt's criticisms of Angela Merkel's decision to admit around 1 million Syrian refugees into Germany and the country's reception of them. Schmidt writes, "A normal man or boy will know his duties and defend his wife, daughter, mother, or sister. Only these Germans of today have turned so brainwashed and unmanly that they are not even capable of that. Schmidt blames the acceptance of a large group of Syrian refugees into Germany on the decline of patriarchal gender roles in that country. What fills the large gap in logic in this explanation is Schmidt's assumption of a fascist mythic past before the decline in which men played the supposedly traditional patriarchal gender role of protecting women from foreign influence. Highlighting supposed threats to the ability of men to protect their women and children solves a difficult political problem for fascist politicians. In liberal democracy, a politician who explicitly attacks freedom and equality will not garner much support. The politics of sexual anxiety is a way to get around this issue in the name of safety. It is a way to attack and undermine the ideals of liberal democracy without being seen as explicitly so doing. By employing the politics of sexual anxiety, a political leader represents, albeit indirectly, freedom and equality as threats. The expression of gender identity or sexual preference is an exercise of freedom. By presenting homosexuals or transgender women as a threat to women and children, and by extension to men's ability to protect them, fascist politics impugns the liberal ideal of freedom. A woman's right to have an abortion is also an exercise of freedom. By representing abortion as a threat to children and to men's control over them, fascist politics impugns the liberal ideal of freedom. A person's right to marry whom they wish is an exercise of freedom. By representing members of one religion or one race as a threat because of the possibility of intermarriage is to impugn the liberal ideal of freedom. The politics of sexual anxiety also undermines equality. When equality is granted to women, the role of men as sole providers for their families is threatened. Highlighting male helplessness in the face of sexual threats to their wives and children accentuates such feelings of anxiety at the loss of patriarchal masculinity. The politics of sexual anxiety is a powerful way to present freedom and equality as fundamental threats without explicitly appearing to reject them. A robust presence of a politics of sexual anxiety is perhaps the most vivid sign of the erosion of liberal democracy. Politicians, then, turn their attention to the sites of the most egregious and concentrated sources of sexual deviance and violent threats, cosmopolitan urban centers. In the book of Genesis, Sodom and Gomorrah are cities that are singled out by God to be destroyed for their wickedness and sin. There is textual controversy over what sins were said to be the reason for the destruction of these cities. But regardless of scholarship, in the historical imagination, the sins have been taken to be sexual in nature, specifically homosexuality. Cities have long been treated in rhetoric and literature as places of decadence and sin, most particularly sexual decadence and sin. Sodom and Gomorrah are the biblical reference points for the source of sexual anxiety, where homosexuality, race mixing, and other sins against fascist ideology are most likely to occur. Chapter 9. Sodom and Gomorrah. That afternoon, at the former officer's dacha, I learned to shoot from the man who raises rabbits for food but does not have the heart to kill them. The animal lover, discussing the cultural attitudes that make this region distinctive, explained it thus. For example, if homosexuals arrived in our town, we would kill them. Nicholas Mulner, In Most Tides, an Island. Chapter 1 of Mein Kampf is titled My Home. It is a short chapter, a mere 3.5 pages. In it, Hitler pays homage to his birthplace, Braunau on the Inn, a little town that lies on the frontier between the two German states, suffused with German nationalist pride and industrious, hard-working people. Sadly, poverty and stern reality led him away from his idyllic small-town home, and, with a valise full of clothes and linen, I went to Vienna full of determination. The second chapter of Mein Kampf, My Studies and Struggles in Vienna, concerns Hitler's experience with Austria's largest and most cosmopolitan city. Vienna, according to its first page, is a poisonous snake. To get to know its poison fangs, one must live there. Hitler describes Vienna as a city dominated and controlled by Jews, who lambaste and insult traditional German culture in favor of a sickeningly decadent facsimile. Hitler decries the lack of German national pride in Vienna. Most of all, Hitler despises Vienna for its cosmopolitanism, its mixture of different cultural and racial groups. I hated the mixture of races displayed in the capital. I hated the motley collection of Czechs, Poles, Hungarians, Ruthenians, Serbs, Croats, and above all, that ever-present fungoid growth, Jews and again Jews. In Germany, there was a romantic tradition in literature and culture that took cities to be the cause of social ills and the countryside as a purifying element. National socialist ideology took this to extremes. Pure German values were rural values, realized in peasant life. The cities, by contrast, were sites of racial defilement, where pure Nordic blood was ruined by mixture with others. As Hitler writes in the second chapter of his unpublished second book, a particular danger of the so-called peaceful economic policy of a people lies in the fact that it initially enables an increase in the population that will no longer be in proportion to the productivity of the people's own land and territory. Not infrequently, this crowding of too many people into an inadequate Lebensraum also leads to difficult social problems. People are now gathered into work centers that do not resemble cultural sites as much as abscesses on the body of the people, places where all evils, vices, and sicknesses appear to unite. They are, above all, hotbeds of blood mixing and bastardization, usually ensuring the degeneration of the race and resulting in that purulent herd in which the maggots of the international Jewish community flourish and cause the ultimate decay of the people. Hitler's denunciations of large cosmopolitan cities and their cultural productions is standard in fascist politics. Hollywood, or its local proxy, often supposedly controlled by Jews, is always destroying traditional values and culture by producing perverted art. In the 1930 manifesto of the Kampfbund für Deutsche Kultur, the official National Socialist Fighting Society for German Culture, Alfred Rosenberg issues a call for resistance to all tendencies in the theater which are damaging to the people. For the theater in nearly all big cities today has become the scene of perverted instincts. We fight against a constantly spreading corruption of our concepts of justice, a corruption which gives the big swindlers practically a free hand in exploiting the people. Whereas cities, to the fascist imagination, are the source of corrupting culture, often produced by Jews and immigrants, the countryside is pure. The official party statement on its attitude toward the farmers and agriculture was published in the National Socialist Völkische Beobachter in 1930, with Hitler's signature, though its actual authorship is unclear. It contains a concise statement of the Nazi ideology that the true values of the nation were to be found in the rural population, that National Socialists see in the farmers the main bearers of a healthy, folkish heredity, the fountain of youth of the people and the backbone of military power. In fascist politics, the family farm is the cornerstone of the nation's values, and family farm communities provide the backbone of its military. Resources that flow to cities must be directed to the rural communities instead, to preserve this vital center of the nation's values. And the rural communities, as the source of the pure blood of the nation, cannot be polluted by outside blood via immigration. It was official Nazi policy that, by bettering the lot of the domestic agricultural laborer and by preventing flight from the land, the importation of foreign agricultural labor becomes unnecessary and will therefore be forbidden. A June 2017 Washington Post Kaiser Foundation survey of almost 1,700 Americans found that attitudes toward immigrants form one of the widest gulfs between U.S. cities and rural communities. 42% of rural residents in the poll agreed with the statement, "Immigrants are a burden on our country because they take our jobs, housing, and health care." Only 16% of urban residents agreed with this characterization of immigrants as burdensome. The poll suggests that the politics of rural versus urban is a promising avenue for sowing division for demagogically minded U.S. politicians, particularly around the topic of immigration. An article for The Guardian, published on April 21st during the 2017 presidential election in France, describes the base for Le Front National and its presidential candidate, Marine Le Pen, as people living in modest towns and country villages far away from big cities. Le Pen's message of hardline security and anti-immigration are characterized as responsible for a surge in rural support for her party, where anti-immigration sentiment is deep and pervasive, even where immigration is very scarce. In the first round of voting, despite receiving less than 5% of the vote in Paris, France's capital and largest city, Le Pen finished a close second to Emmanuel Macron, with regional results pointed to political fracturing between the big cities and more rural areas. In the final round, which Emmanuel Macron won in a landslide, the rural-urban split remained. An article on May 12, 2017 in the BBC summarized their differences in support. Mr. Macron scored best in the big cities, including Paris, where 9 out of 10 voters backed him. It was his strongest area of support. In contrast, Ms. Le Pen's biggest support came from the countryside. Similarly, during the 2016 presidential election in the United States, Donald Trump's harsh anti-immigration rhetoric was particularly popular in rural areas with very few immigrants. Fascist politics aims its message at the populace outside large cities, to whom it is most flattering. It is especially resonant during times of globalization, when economic power swings to the large urban areas as centers of an emerging global economy, as occurred in the 1930s in Europe. Fascist politics highlights the wrongs a globalized economy does to rural areas, adding to it a focus on traditional rural values of self-sufficiency, supposedly put at risk by the success of liberal cities culturally and economically. In the 2014 election for the state legislature in Minnesota, a Republican wave upended the Democratic majority. In a January 25, 2015 Star Tribune article explaining the Republican triumph, in which one Democrat was derided as Metro J by his Republican opponent, Patrick Condon writes on numerous local and national issues, including a new state Senate office building in St. Paul, the legalization of gay marriage, and efforts to bring the Affordable Care Act to Minnesota. Republican candidates in many of the state's furthest reaches capitalized on unease that big city Democrats were inflicting their values on small towns, while hoarding the spoils of the state treasury. The pervasive sense that city dwellers in Minnesota were living off the taxes of the hard-working rural population of Minnesota was a powerful force in the Minnesota Republican triumph in 2014. We pay taxes too, Corden quotes a rural Minnesota resident as saying. But we see a lot of our tax dollars going to urban development in the metro area. We'd like to see some of that share. We'd like to have nice roads too. And yet, as is typical in politics that exacerbates the rural-urban divide during times of globalization, the perception was mythical. In Minnesota, as in many places in the globalized economy, it is the metro areas that are the state's economic engine, generating tax dollars that flow outward to every corner of the state. Fascist politics feeds the insulting myth that hard-working rural residents pay to support lazy urban dwellers. So it is not a surprise that the base of its success is found in a country's rural areas. In a 1980 essay on the composition of support for the Nazi Party, the electoral geography of the Nazi landslide, Nico Pasquier notes that rural and especially agrarian support for Nazism was extensive, and that the Nazis had special success in areas with small farms, a rather homogeneous social structure, strong feelings of local solidarity, and social control. The accuracy of a fascist politician's attacks on cities is not particularly important to their success. These messages resonate with voters who do not live in cities, and they don't need to appeal to urban dwellers. Anti-city rhetoric had a central role in the 2016 U.S. presidential elections. Violent crime rates in the United States in 2016 and 2017 were near historic lows. The most salient instances of violent crimes, mass shootings, were not specifically connected to urban areas and were usually committed by white men. Cities were thriving. The millennial generation in the United States tended to prefer urban to suburban areas. And urban areas were experiencing a tremendous revival. Many areas that in the 1970s and 1980s were the paradigm of blighted urban ghettos, such as Harlem, had experienced, for good or for ill, tremendous gentrification and steeply escalating housing prices. Despite this, U.S. President Donald Trump, during the 2016 U.S. presidential campaign and afterward, regularly spoke of American cities as sites of carnage and blight. For example, in a tweet on January 14, 2017, then-President-elect Trump spoke of burning and crime-infested inner cities of the U.S. Despite remarkable gentrification in American cities, Trump regularly speaks of cities as containing ghettos filled with black people, who he implies are likely criminals. A typical line from one of his campaign speeches was, "Our African-American communities are absolutely in the worst shape that they've ever been in before. Ever, ever, ever. You take a look at the inner cities, you get no education, you get no jobs, you get shot walking down the street." And yet during this time, cities in the United States were enjoying their lowest rates of crime in generations and record low unemployment. Trump's rhetoric about cities makes sense in the context of a more general fascist politics, in which cities are seen as centers of disease and pestilence, containing squalid ghettos filled with despised minority groups living off the work of others. The appeal to the countryside in fascist politics can be obscured in countries with urban centers containing deeply religious neighborhoods, or neighborhoods with impoverished workers from rural areas who are well served by the populist economic policies favored by some authoritarian leaders. Recep Tayyip Erdogan began his national political career as the mayor of Istanbul, Turkey's largest city. Istanbul has large neighborhoods dominated by conservative religious voters, which provided him with an early base of support. Erdogan's populist economic policies also served Istanbul's neglected poor well. However, in 1999, Erdogan chose Sirte, a town in the religiously conservative and restive southeastern part of the country, to give a controversial, anti-secular speech that landed him in prison for inciting hatred based on religious difference. As Erdogan increasingly engaged in fascist politics, his base of support has swung to rural areas. All three of Turkey's largest cities voted against the 2017 referendum, granting Erdogan virtually dictatorial powers. The referendum passed only because of his strong support outside these centers. Large urban centers tend toward particularly high degrees of pluralism. In cities, one is likely to find not just the greatest degree of ethnic and religious diversity, but also the greatest diversity of lifestyles and customs. The literature on National Socialism supports the view that urban areas brought with them a measure of tolerance that served to protect, at least for a while, the populations targeted by the Nazis. According to Richard Grunberger, Jews living in villages and small towns were subjected to window smashing and physical assault, sometimes culminating in murder. This made them seek the anonymity and sense of communal comfort to be found in large centers like Frankfurt and Berlin. Country areas generally tended to be more anti-Semitic than urban ones. In the cities, anti-Jewish feeling was roughly inversely proportional to the city's size. Fascist ideology rejects pluralism and tolerance. In fascist politics, everyone in the chosen nation shares a religion and a way of life, a set of customs. The diversity, with its concomitant tolerance of difference in large urban centers, is therefore a threat to fascist ideology. Fascist politics targets financial elites, cosmopolitans, liberals, and religious, ethnic, and sexual minorities. In many countries, these are characteristically urban populations. Cities, therefore, usefully serve as a proxy target for the classic enemies of fascist politics. In fascist ideology, the rural life is guided by an ethos of self-sufficiency, which breeds strength. In rural communities, one does not need to depend on the state, unlike the parasites in the city. Hitler writes that a lesson he learned from his time in Vienna was that the social task may never consist of welfare work, which is both ridiculous and useless, but rather in removing the deep-seated mistakes in the organization of our economic and cultural life, which are bound to end in degradation of the individual. Richard Walther Dare was a leading Nazi ideologue and one of the most senior commanders of the SS. The thesis of Dare's 1929 essay, The Peasantry as the Key to Understanding the Nordic Race, is that true freedom is realized only in the rural agrarian life of the peasant. In the rural life, one is forced to rely on one's own abilities and be self-sufficient rather than to be a parasite, as Dare argues city dwellers are. In fascism, the state is an enemy. It is to be replaced by the nation, which consists of self-sufficient individuals who collectively choose to sacrifice for a common goal of ethnic or religious glorification. In a tension that we will explore in the next chapter, fascist ideology involves something at least superficially akin to the libertarian ideal of self-sufficiency and freedom from the state. To boost the nation, fascist movements are obsessed with reversing declining birth rates. Large families raised by dedicated homemakers are the goal. In fascist politics, cities are denounced as sites of declining birth rates, which are blamed on the supposed weakening effect of cosmopolitanism on a population, making men and women less capable of fulfilling traditional gender roles, as soldiers and mothers, for example. In a 1927 speech by the Italian fascist leader Benito Mussolini, he writes, "At a certain point, the city starts growing in a diseased, pathological way, not through its own resources, but through external support. The increasing infertility of citizens stands in a direct relationship to the rapid and monstrous growth of the cities. The metropolis spreads, attracting the population from the countryside, which, immediately it has become urbanized, becomes sterile, just like the population which is already there. The city dies. The nation is now made up of people who are old and degenerate and cannot defend itself against a younger people which launches an attack on the now unguarded frontiers. Mussolini denounces the world's great cities, such as New York, for their teeming populations of non-whites. In fascist ideology, the city is a place where members of the nation go to age and die, childless, surrounded by the vast hordes of despised others, breeding out of control, their children permanent burdens on the state. Cities, in the fascist worldview, are collective enterprises where people rely on public infrastructure, the state, for survival and comfort. Residents of cities do not hunt or grow their food, as in fascist mythology. They purchase it at stores. This runs counter to the fascist ideal of rural agrarian self-sufficiency. In fascist ideology, it is the nation that provides, not the state. Small, ethnically or religiously pure communities composed of self-sufficient individuals working as a community. We find clear evidence of this ideology in the contemporary United States as well. In a 2017 poll, there was also a particularly large gulf between rural and urban respondents to the poll surrounding notions of hard work and self-sufficiency. When asked, "In your opinion, which is generally more often to blame if a person is poor?" 49% of rural residents agreed with the response, "lack of effort on their own part," while 46% agreed with the response, "difficult circumstances beyond their control." In contrast, only 37% of urban residents agreed with the response, "lack of effort on their own part," whereas 56% agreed with difficult circumstances beyond their control. Fascist politics characteristically represents the minority populations living in cities as rodents or parasites living off the honest hard work of rural populations. As Hitler writes in Mein Kampf, "Originally the Aryan was probably a nomad, and then, as time went on, he became settled. This, if nothing else, proves that he was never a Jew. No, the Jew is not a nomad, for even the nomad had already a definite attitude towards the conception work. In the Jew, however, that conception has no place. He was never a nomad, but was ever a parasite in the bodies of other nations." In the National Socialist education system, Jews are not seen in the occupations of factory worker, bricklayer, blacksmith, locksmith, miner, farmer, plasterer. In other words, the Jew avoided work with his hands and avoided heavy labor while living off the sweat of his neighbors. He is a parasite, like the mistletoe on a tree. In fascist politics, the laziness of minorities in cities is cured only by forcing them into hard labor. Hard labor, in Nazi ideology, had a remarkable power. It could purify an inherently lazy race. Chapter 10. Arbeit macht frei. In 2017, successive hurricanes of enormous strength hit the United States. In August, Hurricane Harvey devastated the city of Houston in the state of Texas. In September, Hurricane Maria had a considerably worse impact on the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico, many of whose residents were left for months without power. Those born in Puerto Rico, like those born in Houston, are American citizens. And yet the difference between the reaction to the hurricanes was extreme, both federally from President Trump and among many white Americans living on the mainland United States. In an October 2017 article in The Washington Post by Jenna Johnson headlined, "Many Trump voters who got hurricane relief in Texas aren't sure Puerto Ricans should." She quotes Fred Maddox, a 75-year-old Houston resident, on the topic of whether Puerto Rico should receive the kind of federal aid that Houston did. "It shouldn't be up to us, really. I don't think so. He's trying to wake them up. Do your job. Be responsible." The Maddox family did not have flood insurance, but nevertheless received $14,000 in federal aid from FEMA. The article ends with a quote about Maddox's view of President Trump's differential responses to the disaster. "He likes having a businessman in office, especially one who's not afraid to speak the painful truth. It's time, he said, we had someone in there to fight for us." In fascist ideology, in times of crisis and need, the state reserves support for members of the chosen nation, for us, and not them. The justification is invariably because they are lazy, lack a work ethic, and cannot be trusted with state funds, and because they are criminal and seek only to live off state largesse. In fascist politics, they can be cured of laziness and thievery by hard labor. This is why the gates of Auschwitz and Buchenwald had emblazoned on them the slogan, "Arbeit macht frei," work shall make you free. In Nazi ideology, Jews were lazy, corrupt criminals who spent their time scheming to take the money of hard-working Aryans, a job that was facilitated by the state. The 1919 guidelines of the Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, DAP, the German Workers' Party, the original name of the Nazi Party, ask, "Who is the DAP fighting against?" The answer is, "Against all those who create no value, who make high profits without any mental or physical work. We fight against the drones in the state. These are mostly Jews. They live a good life. They reap where they have not sown." Their remedy was to dismantle the state and replace it with the nation. In contrast to the state, the nation lacks mechanisms like welfare, which Hitler denounces for robbing individuals of their capacity for economic independence. The state represented the redistribution of the wealth of hard-working citizens to undeserving minorities outside the dominant ethnic or religious community, who would take advantage of them. There is a large amount of social scientific work on white American support for welfare programs, a somewhat ill-defined category in point of fact. Most often, American opposition to welfare is represented as a manifestation of a commitment to individualism, of support and desire for nurturing an ethic of self-sufficiency. And yet, a dominant theme emerging from research on white Americans' attitude toward welfare is that the single largest predictor of white Americans' attitude toward programs described as welfare is their attitude toward the judgment that black people are lazy. As the Princeton political scientist Martin Gillens writes in his 1996 paper, Race Coding and White Opposition to Welfare, the perception that blacks are lazy has a larger effect on white Americans' welfare policy preferences than does economic self-interest, beliefs about individualism, or views about the poor in general. Of course, variables such as racism, the belief that the poor are lazy, and endorsement of certain forms of individualism are not independent of one another. Many white Americans hold false beliefs about who is poor. There is widespread ignorance of the fact that the majority of those who benefit from welfare programs are white. Furthermore, as in the previous chapter, the valorization of self-sufficiency is at the core of fascist ideology, inextricably intermingled with hostility towards certain hated minority groups. We might distinguish between respective beliefs in the laziness of black people and of poor people and in the value of self-sufficiency. But in those susceptible to fascist ideology, they often come together. In fascist ideology, the ideal of hard work is weaponized against minority populations. The French neo-fascist party Le Front National is viciously anti-immigrant. Party representatives regularly lambaste immigrants as lazy freeloaders living off the hard work and diligence of the true French people. For example, Marine Le Pen, its current head, said on the 2017 presidential campaign trail that interlopers from all over the world want to transform France into a giant squat. The hard work versus laziness dichotomy is, like law-abiding versus criminal, at the heart of the fascist division between us and them. But what is most terrifying about these rhetorical divides is that it is typical of fascist movements to attempt to transform myths about them into reality through social policy. We see this regularly with movements of refugees. Hannah Arendt writes, "It was always a too little noted hallmark of fascist propaganda that it was not satisfied with lying, but deliberately proposed to transform its lies into reality. Thus, Das Schwarze Korps conceded several years before the outbreak of the war that people abroad did not completely believe the Nazi contention that all Jews are homeless beggars who can only subsist as parasites in the economic organism of other nations. But foreign public opinion, they prophesied, would in a few years be given the opportunity to convince itself of this fact when the German Jews would be driven out across the borders like a pack of beggars. For such a fabrication of a lying reality, no one was prepared. The essential characteristic of fascist propaganda was never its lies, for this is something more or less common to propaganda everywhere and of every time. The essential thing was that they exploited the age-old Occidental prejudice which confuses reality with truth, and made that true which until then could only be stated as a lie. Traumatized, penniless refugees coming en masse across borders require state aid and support before entering labor markets. They require such support to learn the language and, initially at least, for shelter, food, and job training. By subjecting members of a despised minority to brutal treatment and then sending them as refugees across borders into other countries, fascist movements can create an apparent reality underlying their claim that members of that group are lazy and dependent on state aid or petty crime. By such methods, they also export the conditions that make fascist politics effective. Arendt's point is that fascist unreality is a promissory note on the way to a future reality that transforms into fact at least some basis of what was once stereotyped myth. Fascist unreality is, as Arendt explains, a prelude to fascist policy. Fascist politics and fascist policy cannot easily be divorced from each other. The strong temptation for those who employ fascist politics once they assume power is to use their position of power to make their once fantastical statements increasingly more plausible. In this way, as a prelude to ethnic cleansing or genocide, governments will artificially create the conditions inside the state that seem to legitimize the subsequent brutal treatment of the population. A good example is the Slovak state, led by Josef Tiso, that emerged after Nazi Germany invaded Czechoslovakia in 1939. In his 2015 book, Black Earth, The Holocaust as History and Warning, the Yale historian Timothy Snyder writes, "During the transition from Czechoslovak to Slovak law, Slovaks and others stole with enthusiasm from the Jews. Tiso and the leaders of the new state saw this as part of a natural process whereby Slovaks would displace Jews and, in some measure, Slovak Catholics would displace Slovak Protestants as the middle class. Laws expropriating Jews thus created an artificial Jewish question. What to do with all of these impoverished people? Snyder subsequently explains that the solution Slovak leaders chose was to deport their Jewish population to Auschwitz. After first seeking assurances from the Nazi leader Heinrich Himmler that the 58,000 Slovakian Jews they sent would not be returned. The 2017 Rohingya crisis of ethnic cleansing and mass murder did not occur out of the blue. As written earlier, it began in earnest in 2012 after the rape and murder of a Buddhist woman by several Rohingya men, after which many Rohingyas were sequestered in hundreds of villages and prohibited from traveling. According to the June 2016 report of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, starting in 2012, the majority of Rohingyas require official authorization to move between and often within townships. In northern Rakhine State, for example, a village departure certificate is required to stay overnight in another village. The procedures to secure travel are onerous and time-consuming. Failure to comply with requirements can result in arrest and prosecution. Restrictions routinely lead to extortion and harassment by law enforcement and public officials. Protracted displacement, overcrowding in camps, the lack of livelihoods and constraints on all aspects of life exacerbate tensions and the risk of domestic violence. The treatment of the Rohingya minority in Myanmar robbed them of opportunities to work, and the constant harassment and policing no doubt created a mental health crisis among the population. All of this served to reinforce negative stereotypes of Rohingya people, which served to legitimize the brutal and inhumane treatment of them that culminated in the 2017 ethnic cleansing of their population, as well as raising opposition to their acceptance as refugees in other lands. Frantz Fanon, a psychiatrist by training, was born in Martinique and lived in both France and North Africa. Fanon's 1952 Black Skin, White Masks, published when he was only 27, is one of the classic anti-colonial texts of the 20th century. In a description of how French police treat Algerians, Fanon concisely spells out how the regular practice of the colonizer, in this case the French police in Algeria, can create the material conditions underlying a racist stereotype. The French stereotype of Arabs was that they were shifty, sneaky, dirty, and distrustful. But Fanon points out that this stereotype was created by the way that the French police regularly treated Arabs and the fact that French rule impoverished them. Anyone would have a hunted, evasive look of distrust when they were subject to regularly being stopped by police in broad daylight. This is the only natural response to such treatment. The practice of French police itself caused colonial subjects to behave in a way that accorded with the stereotype. Summarizing the situation, Fanon concludes, "It is the racist who creates the inferiorized." The United States has its own history of policies that feed stereotypes and make them appear real. The structure of policing and incarceration, and the white reaction to them, is central to explaining how racialized mass incarceration in the United States constructs and seemingly legitimates negative group stereotypes. The chance of being incarcerated at least once in one's lifetime is 1 in 3 for Black American men. It is 1 in 17 for white American men. But the tragedy of this statistic does not end with an incarcerated person's release from prison. Those who have experienced incarceration face dauntingly difficult job prospects. A history of incarceration functions like a scarlet letter for employers. In a 2003 study demonstrating the devastating effects of prior incarceration on the search for employment, the Harvard University sociologist Diva Pager writes that incarceration becomes a label for individuals, much as college graduates or welfare recipients. The negative credential associated with a criminal record represents a unique mechanism of stratification, in that it is the state that certifies particular individuals in ways that qualify them for discrimination or social exclusion. In her landmark study, Pager discovered large effects of prior incarceration on employment opportunity. She used teams of auditors, two of whom were black and two of whom were white, with similar appearances and resumes. One member was told to report on 18-month incarceration for cocaine trafficking, and the other was told to report no criminal record. Each week, the team member who reported a criminal record would switch. Together, the teams applied for entry-level jobs in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Among whites, a criminal record reduced the likelihood of a callback interview for an entry-level job by 50%. Pager's white auditors who reported no criminal record had a 34% callback rate, and her white auditors who reported a criminal record had a 17% callback rate. The black auditors she used, with very similar resumes, had a 14% callback rate when they did not report a criminal record, suggesting that black Americans who report no criminal record already fare worse in seeking entry-level employment than white Americans who do report a criminal record. Only 5% of black applicants reporting a criminal record received callback interviews. According to Pager's study, both race and previous incarceration record have a drastic effect on one's employment chances. Adding race and previous incarceration record together makes employment prospects dramatically worse. Rising incarceration rates among black populations can naturally be expected to lead to rising unemployment among that population. White American stereotypes of black Americans as lazy and violent derive from the very beginning of the United States, where these attributes were regularly used to justify the enslavement of America's black population. After slavery, these stereotypes were used to justify the equally brutal practice of convict leasing, whereby large portions of the black population of the formerly antebellum South were arrested for petty crimes and leased to iron, steel, and coal companies for hard labor, often with fatal consequences. The mechanisms underlying the racialized mass incarceration of black Americans are part of a long tradition of justifying stereotypes of this population as lazy, that is, unable, because supposedly unwilling, to gain employment. In the 1960s, the Kennedy and Johnson administrations responded to the civil rights movement by pairing job training and anti-poverty programs with punitive anti-crime measures. When Richard Nixon ran for the office of president in 1968, he used urban unrest to change the subject from social justice to law and order. He did so at a time of salient moments of urban unrest but declining incarceration rates. Historian Elizabeth Hinton writes, "When Richard Nixon took office in 1969, he inherited a penal system that had been shedding prisoners. The 1960s produced the single largest reduction in the population of federal and state prisons in the nation's history, with 16,500 fewer inmates in 1969 than in 1950. Despite this trend toward decarceration, under the auspices of the Nixon administration, the federal government began to construct prisons at unprecedented rates." In turning the nation's attention to law and order, the Nixon administration successfully made the case to drop Johnson's anti-poverty programs and job initiatives, focusing instead on punitive crime measures, especially in urban centers populated by African Americans. Hinton and others provide strong reasons to believe that Nixon and members of his administration were well aware that their policies were going to lead to dramatically increased incarceration among black citizens. There are disagreements and open questions in the now large body of literature on the causes of the current crisis in mass incarceration